Coming up, Tom Haverstraw makes his return to the Kevin O'Connor Show to talk about everything going on around the NBA. And there's a lot to get to, so let's get started. All right, joining me now from the Finder and the Big Number, Tom Haverstraw. Tom, how are you?
Kev, what's going on, man? Been a long time.
I know, it's been a minute, Tom. We have a lot to catch up on in the NBA world right now, starting with the Ja Morant saga. As of now, they have lost multiple games in a row, lost again on Wednesday night. And we got a report from Sam Amick over at The Athletic that the Kings and Wolves are monitoring Ja Morant. That was what Amick reported at The Athletic. Windhorst was over at Yahoo Sports Daily also on Wednesday, and he said something interesting that contrasts that a little bit, but sort of not really. Windy said, the best move for the Grizzlies is to keep Ja Morant, use the picks they got in the Bane trade. And he said, quote, and that's what they're going to try to do. And he said he could try to throw out teams and hypotheticals and all that, but people would aggregate him. But what he said clearly, he said, quote, I don't think there's actually any action on this at all. It's all hypothetical. That didn't stop you, Tom. You and Dan Devine on the Big Number this week from a bunch of fake jaw trades. You talked about the Kings and the Mavs and the Nets and the Rockets and the Bucks as fits for Ja Morant. And we're in a situation here, though, where my main thought here, Tom, is this is getting ugly. It's getting ugly for Memphis. Kelly Eco over at Yahoo Sports was at the game last night between the Rockets and the Grizzlies, and he wrote, Morant's body language was off all evening. Outside of a mini briefing midway through the fourth, Morant didn't speak to Isalo, the Grizzlies head coach. During timeouts, Morant would be off to himself at either end of the bench. There was no reassuring handshakes or taps from Isalo whenever Morant was subbed out. The tension palpable within FedEx Forum. Tom, I don't think this is going to change with the return of Zach Edey. I think this is something that could only get uglier and uglier, which is why you guys are right to talk about a bunch of these trade scenarios.
Yeah, Kev, I think this is has the potential to go full Jimmy Butler. You know, like the passive-aggressive remarks to the media, the suspensions, we're already past that point. But the question is whether we're going to see a Jimmy Butler-esque, just full-on dysfunction and creating an uncomfortable atmosphere that is so toxic that no one wants to be there anymore. And it's just going to come to a point where Ja Morant eventually comes to a point where he's just going to either ask out directly or the organization is just going to say, this is way too uncomfortable for everyone involved and we need to move on from this. It's easy to say that here, as we sit here on November 6th, that everything's going to be fine. They're just going to keep everything together. But these are real human beings and real organizations and workplaces, right? We can sit here and say, yeah, it's uncomfortable. People are going to get a little bit testy here and there, but we're not actually on the team plane. We're not actually in the locker room. We're not actually at the team meals, at the film sessions. And we already know that it has reached a point that they needed to suspend the guy. One game with a very terse, just one sentence statement. And we know that this is very uncomfortable for everyone involved. But as we saw with the Jimmy Butler situation, it can get a lot uglier. And I wonder if Ja Morant and his father, who's courtside at every home game, I wonder if they start pressing some buttons to make this really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I my gut tells me that could be where this goes. And ultimately, like, Ja has sucked this year. I mean, he hit a game winner at some point, but he's shooting 38% from the field. He's shooting 14% from three. I mentioned on my podcast earlier in the week with Jason Timpf that at that time, he had many airballed three-point attempts as he had made three-point attempts. He's since made one. So he has six made three-pointers, five airballed three-pointers out of, so far this year, 43 total attempts. I mean, his shot has fallen apart. He's not getting to the rim as often. He's not putting in great effort on defense. He quit on the team, which is why they suspended him. It's ugly already. And at this point, I mean, with the Kings, you know, they need a point guard. It makes sense for them to monitor them. The Wolves are interesting. And I have a fake trade here, Tom, that I wanted to show you involving Ja Morant, because I think with Ja, the Wolves are a team that does make some sense. They make some sense. It's not perfect sense because of the Ja Morant fit, but you could send back Mike Conley, Naz Reid, Rob Dillingham, Leonard Miller. That works salary-wise. Something would have to be diverted. 2032 first-round swap. This is similar to the Kyrie Irving trade that we saw when Brooklyn and Dallas made a swap. You get the Mike Conley return in Memphis for his final season. You can sell that if you're the Grizzlies. And for the Wolves, like, Morant clearly has risks, but there's no denying the highs that he has had in his past as a player. And this is a team that needs a point guard, an upgrade at point guard. If Dillingham's not going to do it with Conley's fall off, I'm intrigued by the idea for Minnesota, but I'd have a real pit in my stomach if Ja Morant was a guy that I'd be betting on to elevate my team from Western Conference to NBA Finals. But what do you think about this trade idea, Tom?
Memphis should accept that right away. Don't even think about it. If you get Naz Reid, you get a leader in Mike Conley and Rob Dillingham. Kev, I can't wait to talk to you about what is going on in Memphis with Rob Dillingham. After this preseason, he was awesome. Awesome. He led the entire NBA in assists this preseason. He had a great performance for a couple of weeks there where it looked like he was going to be a real part of this rotation. And if you're the Memphis Grizzlies, I'm like, yeah, I'm getting that guy. Free this dude out of Minnesota because he's clearly buried in this rotation. And I feel like Rob Dillingham can do a lot of the things that Ja Morant was used to be doing, is just getting into the paint. And yeah, he's not going to finish at above the rim like Ja Morant. But if you're going to take a guy who's an incredibly good and talented scorer, really slithery in getting into the paint and can really pass the ball, I think that he made a leap this preseason in doing that. Memphis should absolutely do that with Naz Reid also in that package. From the Minnesota side, I mean, you're putting a lot of eggs in the basket of Rudy Gobert's defense, and they just have not been able to defend at all when Rudy Gobert hasn't been on the floor. And I'm worried that you put Ja Morant on this team without Mike Conley and his leadership, it all falls on the shoulders of Rudy Gobert and Anthony Edwards to basically take that burden of playing high-level defense nonstop and being able to plug all those gaps, both at a leadership standpoint without Mike Conley and also defensively. I worry about Ja Morant, his ability to reach those levels in the postseason with all of the warts of Rudy Gobert defensively and offensively at the highest levels of the sport. But then again, you look at the standings, Minnesota has to do something, whether it's internally or externally, to right this ship.
Well, ultimately, Tom, I do think that's why with Minnesota, first of all, that's my fake trade. I would not do that if I'm Minnesota. It's really a trade constructed from the Memphis standpoint. Like, well, here's what we would need. If I'm Minnesota and I'm giving up Rob Dillingham, who I traded to first to move up to go get, I'm not trading my 2032 swap. I'm not giving that up as well. But ultimately, I do think like this is the type of thing I'm sure Memphis would want if they were to trade Ja. That's probably like the most that they would really realistically get, unless Ja Morant returns to his prior highs that we've seen. But ultimately, you're spot on about Minnesota. And that leads me to a thought here right now, Tom. Minnesota right now is not an NBA Finals contender. And we saw in their loss on Wednesday night to the New York Knicks, the Knicks just got layup over and over and over in the game when Rudy Gobert was off the floor. And this is one of the concerns about this team right now, is because with the Wolves, like, we're throwing the highlights right up on screen right now if you're watching on YouTube. Karl-Anthony Towns didn't have a big night, 15, 10, and 4, but we're seeing the Knicks facilitate through him, getting him touches and opportunities, guys cutting to the rim anytime Gobert is off the floor. Guys, like, it's not even transition baskets, but guys getting to the rim with ease. Nobody's getting back. There's no help defense. And Naz Reid and Julius Randle sometimes out there together, not a lot of rim protection, not a lot of great size. And it's unfair to Naz Reid to ask him to be a rim protector. He's better as a four. But ultimately, it just feels like a fundamentally flawed team right now. Everybody talks about the point guard spot for the Wolves. But the problem, the biggest problem on the team, is what happens without Rudy Gobert out there. And so the numbers so far this season, Tom, with Gobert on the floor, the Wolves have a 109.7 defensive rating, which would be the equivalent of third in the NBA. With Gobert off the floor, they have a 134.8 defensive rating, the equivalent of last. And the shot distribution numbers are really where that difference is apparent. When Gobert is on the floor, only 20% of the shots they allow are at the rim. When Gobert is off the floor, 32% of the shots they allow are at the rim. And so there's a massive difference, including as we saw with the Knicks dropping 137 on them, with Gobert on and off, teams just getting to the basket night in, night out. And that's the biggest issue for Minnesota right now, on top of the point guard issue, which is huge. And I just look at this team and I'm like, they've probably been surpassed by multiple teams in the West right now.
Yeah, and Rudy Gobert is already, what, 33, turning 34?
Mm-hmm.
This is as good as it's going to get. Like, it's going to, the decline, if it hasn't started already, it's going to happen, right? So if you're the Minnesota Timberwolves, you got to figure out a way to defend at a high level with not everything being on Rudy Gobert having to play 48 minutes a game. Kev, I'm so glad you brought up these numbers. The other number I wanted to point out here with Rudy Gobert on the floor and off the floor, when he's on the floor, the Minnesota Timberwolves are allowing just 42 points in the paint every 100 possessions. When he's off the floor, it goes up to 61. So 42 to 61 points in the paint every 100 possessions. It kind of illustrates that it is a red carpet to the rim when Rudy Gobert is not out there. You got Julius Randle, Naz Reid, not known for their rim protection at all. But this is something that it is part and parcel of what the Minnesota Timberwolves, their identity as a team, is that we're going to have Anthony Edwards offensively just be such a heliocentric, everything, all the gravity is around him, and Julius Randle playing bully ball. But defensively, it all comes down to Rudy Gobert. And when you got a 7-footer, mid-30s, and everything in your defense funnels to him, you better hope that he stays healthy and defies the age curve, because that is their only hope of contending in the Western Conference.
It's tough, man. And I think, like, you get Wolves fans. I see some posts show up on my For You page about, you know, Chris Finch, he's got to play Johan Berenger. It's like, if you're relying on Johan Berenger to be your backup five, it's as a rookie, a teenager, very raw out of France, it's a lot to ask, but they don't have any other answers. And ultimately, I think this goes back to the issue with Finch last year. Finch last season, I'm like, where's Terrence Shannon? Where's Rob Dillingham? Why are you not investing time into these young players to possibly have them ready for the postseason? And it's the same thing again this year. Dillingham not playing consistent minutes. Terrence Shannon not playing consistent minutes every night. Those guys should be playing more. You should just throw out Berenger and see what he does. I mean, he's a great shot blocker, even if he's raw, if he gets into foul trouble, for 10, 15 minutes per game. If he elevates you from last in the NBA in defensive rating when Gobert is off the floor to 20th, like, that makes a big difference over the course of a full season. And so I have some issues with Finch's handling of the youth on that team, Tom.
I just, you know, called the game with the Blazers last night on Wednesday night, OKC and Portland. And one thing OKC did with AJ Mitchell last year is they played him 77% of his minutes last year with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander or with Jalen Williams, J-Dub. And there's this, I was told by another executive around the league, is that this is a really smart thing for OKC. Something they do really well is they take guys, two-way contracts, rookies, second-round picks, and they integrate them in the real rotation and get them to see what it looks like with a lot of talent around you, what the game is supposed to be played like, instead of just giving those guys garbage time minutes, not next to Anthony Edwards, not next to Rudy Gobert, not next to Julius Randle. And so what they're doing is they're developing talent through integrating them right into the full rotation. So AJ Mitchell last year seemed like he might have been struggling at times to stay above water with a lot of the first unit guys out there on both ends of the floor. But look at how he's doing this year. It's not an accident that AJ Mitchell looks like not just an NBA player, but a really good NBA player, a second round pick, two-way contract last year, and is now, as of last, I think before the game on Wednesday night, he was their second highest scorer on the team, total points scored. So Rob Dillingham and Shannon, these guys got to play and not just be buried on the bench in the doghouse, because I do think developmentally, they would really, really benefit from having that sunshine.
100%. I mean, look, Conley's fallen off a cliff. He's a borderline NBA player at this point. I mean that with all due respect. He's had an unbelievable career. But at this point, like, you can't rely on Mike Conley in the postseason. So you have to give an opportunity to these other young guys on your roster. If you're not getting rim protection from Naz Reid and Julius Randle, you have to try a fourth big in the rotation and give a chance to Yohan Berenguer, who can block shots with his eyes closed. He's unbelievable at blocking shots. He's very natural at it. So I think that's very important for Finch before they make any big moves, is play the kids more, see how it works out. If you start losing every night, well, that maybe then it's very clear you have to make a move. But at this point, I think they first have to invest in the youth, see how it helps the team out. And then that's when you can talk about panic trades for a Ja Morant. But at this point, Tom, play the kids. Let's move on to the Houston Rockets, who beat the Memphis Grizzlies last night. Houston's offense so far this year, Tom, number one in the NBA. 122.4 offensive rating. They have wins versus the Nets, Raptors, Celtics, Mavericks, and Grizzlies. Not the best competition so far this year, but my goodness, there's reasons for optimism. Şengün, 43% from three on 3.3 attempts per game, both career highs. He's playmaking around different positions. They're putting the ball in his hands at the elbows. He's facilitating, looks like Jokic at times. His 82 touches per game, up from 62 last year. Amen Thompson, reason number two. You can have him go full court, coast to coast, get by guys. And I love the way they're putting him into different positions. Sometimes he's in the dunker spot, getting lob opportunities. He's a guy who just plays within the flow of the offense with quick, instant decisions, finding cutters and shooters. The versatility of a guy like him with this increased usage, I think, is becoming quickly apparent with some of the numbers he's putting up. And then our guy, Reed Shepard, reason number three, stunk it up on opening night against the Oklahoma City Thunder. But he's getting more comfortable facilitating kickouts with accuracy after he gets into the paint. And the three-pointer, taking five per game, hitting over 40% of them, hitting very well off the dribble, very well, very deep off the catch. Reed Shepard is reason number three is their backup. But Alperen Şengün, Amen Thompson, and Reed Shepard, to me, Tom, it's feeling like we're seeing early signs of the Rockets successfully replacing Fred VanVleet. Do you feel the same in how it's resulting into these great early returns for Houston's offense? Or is this a function of a weak schedule, the weak opponents they've faced so far?
No, I'm buying in. Amen Thompson is a much better playmaker and ball handler than I think a lot of people gave him credit for at the start of last season. But as you saw as the season progressed, he was getting triple doubles. He was leading the offense. And as you pointed out, this preseason is like the Fred VanVleet injury certainly come playoff time could rear its head, and they're going to have some struggles being able to have a competent offense when things get real tight. But Amen Thompson, Alperen Şengün, KD, Reed Shepard, these are guys who can run your offense in a pinch. And I do think that the collective playmaking and ball handling is much better than advertised. And Fred VanVleet, who knows, come down the line, it might come back to hurt them, is that they did not upgrade if they don't upgrade at the point guard position. But right now, man, I'm all in. And I think, to your point, being able to have this identity as a team that's going to have these two big lineups, and depending on how you talk about it, four big lineups with Jabari Smith Jr. and KD being seven-footers, essentially. The offensive rebound rate when those guys are on the floor, I'm talking about KD, Steven Adams, and Alperen Şengün, when they're on the floor, their offensive rebound rate is 47%, Kev. I don't think I've ever seen that before, where you're recovering every other missed shot. You basically get 1.5 possessions every time you get the ball. That's absurd. That's absurd. It's the number one rate in the league. And when you look at the way that this team is built, they were able to pivot off of the Fred VanVleet look and pivot into this two big lineup and just beating you guys every time down the floor on the boards.
It's absolutely unbelievable watching those lineups. I think it's like it's different than most other teams are using two bigs. We see two bigs a lot more in the NBA, but we're not seeing two bigs plus Kevin Durant, plus Jabari Smith, plus Amen Thompson. I mean, he's big too and a great rebounder. He plays as a five sometimes with the way they use him in the dunker spot. They use him as a screener. Like in some of those highlights I showed on screen, it's Amen Thompson setting screens for Reed Shepard, or sometimes it's Amen Thompson being used in a two-man action with Alperen Şengün. It just feels like, I don't know if they're going to sustain the number one offensive rating as the schedule gets tougher, but it's not like in the two games they lost, their offense suffered necessarily. I think there's just more dynamics and layers to this team, in part because of Kevin Durant, with just Kevin Durant doing KD things, but also just all these other younger guys getting better. Şengün is clearly better this year. Amen Thompson looks like a guy who's taking a leap. Reed Sheppard getting comfortable in a backup role. All these little things add up for the team. And I think you're seeing a great defense also develop a very, very good offense, even if it's not truly number one. But I am buying the early returns so far the Houston Rockets. And I think, Tom, like, this is like something to monitor, man. Like, what if they stay top five offense all year long? I don't know if they're going to necessarily be able to take down OKC, a team that, you know, people talking about them winning 70 this year, but they surely will have a chance to do that if your offense is reaching this level on top of having such an elite defense.
And also, not unlike when guys who are struggling in some sort of scoring drought, they need to see the ball go through the basket, you know, yeah, get a layup, get to the free throw line, see the ball go through. Sometimes seeing is believing. And for a team like this to see their identity as this huge team that's going to be able to collectively make up the difference, that the sum of the parts is greater than the whole. I always botch that metaphor. But Fred VanVleet being out, that they can see that they can win playing this style, I think is actually going to pay dividends for them, is that they know they can win this way, that they know they can get high quality shots. They know that they can play with this brand of basketball and still have success out there. I do think that buy-in is hugely important in the NBA. So I think for all these guys that we're talking about, getting this, even if it's a soft schedule, getting the results that they want is going to go a long way for Ime Udoka to solidify this identity of this team. And with all the injuries across the league, you can't say that this team doesn't have an identity. They know who they are, and they're beating teams up with it.
Tom, I mentioned Oklahoma City as somebody people say, oh, could they win 70? Well, they lost their first game on Wednesday night against your Portland Trailblazers. The Blazers took them down with a 20-point comeback against Oklahoma City. Number five and three so far this season, Portland is, with the 15th-ranked offensive rating, the 8th-ranked defensive rating. And I'll tell you what, Tom, in that fourth quarter, Denny Avdija looked like a superstar, in all capital letters, superstar, scoring, yep, playmaking, doing literally everything, Tom. Denny looked amazing.
I remember coming on this show last year, the second half of the year, and just every game coming to you, Kev, and being like, this guy's making the leap. Most improved player. He's going to be a 25-5 guy next season. And that's exactly what he's doing. You know, this guy is, I think, just he's an all-star. Like, if he keeps this up, he's an all-star. The stat we gave last night on the broadcast was that players who have averaged Denny Avdija's numbers, all 100% of them since 2000 have been all-stars. Like, this dude is playing all NBA all-star caliber basketball. He loves contact, dude. Like, the way that he puts his shoulder into you and finishes at a high level, he gets and ones all the time. He's top five in fouls drawn. Like, people complain about Shai Gilgeous-Alexander and all the foul calls he gets. Dude, Denny Avdija is going to barrel right through you every single time. And guys can't stop fouling. They cannot legally guard this dude, and he wants it. You can tell that Denny Avdija is hungry for this spotlight, and he's deserving of it. You know, the Blazers have figured out Jeremy Grant coming off the bench, the highest scoring player off the bench this season, to move space for Denny Avdija. They're going small, 13 minutes a game with Denny and Jeremy Grant at the 4 and 5 positions. And their offensive rating when they go small is 130, Kevin. They are blowing the doors off of people when they go small with Denny and JG out there. And a big reason why is they get that ball in transition and they go turbo style. Denny Avdija's nickname, Turbo, is for a reason. They try to run you out of the gym, and Denny Avdija does not slow down for anybody. And against a Thunder team on the second night of a back-to-back, when they got in at 3 a.m. the night before from their trip, no Chet Holmgren, no Lu Dort to slow things down, Denny Avdija was a superstar down the stretch. Absolutely. You're 100% right about that.
I mean, look, I think anytime there's guys who have big second halves or last couple months of the season, there'll be questions. Oh, is this for real? Or is this people taking it light on them at the end of the year? They're not a true playoff team, yada, yada, yada. Well, he's doing everything he did at the end of last season and more. than what we saw in February, March, April last year with Denny. He looks like a complete basketball player. And even in that game, he's 5-for-17 in the game. Didn't have his best scoring performance the first three quarters, but the way he, I think it was the last possession or last two possessions of the third quarter, he had a bucket and an assist. And that entire fourth quarter, just the playmaking, the feel, the decisions, the scoring, the versatility, getting into the paint, hit some tough layups. I mean, he's going against a great defense with or without Chet and Lu Dort. And he just looks for real. The Blazers as a whole, Tom, 5-3, they look like a team to me that is going to be in that play-in borderline playoff conversation. And they do indeed look like a team taking a leap at this point,
yeah,
with the Blazers. I think this is very, very much for real with them. And I think also Chauncey Billups, this whole situation with him getting arrested, Tiago Splitter, there's been no setbacks installing an unexpected new head coach. Is it possible Tiago Splitter becoming the head coach is a blessing in disguise for the Blazers?
Well, every time down the floor, he is doing this. He's trying to get them to run every time down the floor. And the numbers don't lie. The Blazers get to their first shot quicker than any team in the NBA. 10.1 seconds, according to Inpredictable.com. They try to get you in transition off of makes, off of made free throws. It's insane. The way that Tiago Splitter ran this program over in France last year and won the championship in that league, he's doing it here and installed an offense that is basically 7 seconds or less in the modern era. And it's working, man. Like, a lot of times last season, the offense got bogged down. You know, when you talk about the Blazers last season, defensively, they were top five, turning you over. Tamani Kamara was insane. Matisse Thybulle, the way that they create chaos defensively was awesome. But I think the entire organization and the team looked at this and said, if we can get you on 5-on-4s, 4-on-3s, 2-on-1s with that defense, and just run you off the floor, it's going to be a whole lot easier to run offense. And the offense has been so much better this season. And they still need to make their three-point shots. They still need to space the floor. Jrue Holiday has been an excellent addition. Scoot Henderson being sidelined has hurt them. And Blake Wesley has been awesome when he was healthy and being an absolute disruptor. Unfortunately, he broke his foot, and he's going to be out for the next three or so months. But this team, they are super fun to watch. If you like up-tempo basketball, mm-hmm. if you like defense, like get in your jersey defense, this Blazers team is for you. And I'm biased because I'm on the broadcast, but they are super fun to watch because they play so hard. And that is kind of the DNA of this team. They're going to outwork you and outplay you in terms of effort. And that's what it takes to pick up full court and run up and down the floor. You know this, Kev. Every coach talks about how we want to play faster this year. We want to get out in transition. But the Blazers are actually walking that walk by playing in transition offensively, getting into their offense super quick, and also picking you up 94 feet and creating so much havoc defensively, man.
I mean, look, I'm a little biased too because we do a show together. But the Blazers broadcast is also excellent. You know, Brooke does great. Kevin, Lamar, the whole broadcast, you know, is very well put together. One of the better, if not the best, local broadcasts in the NBA. Very, very much always enjoy the Blazers broadcast and how it's put together. While you were broadcasting that game, Tom, the Celtics beat the Wizards. And Jaylen Brown dropped 35 points in the game, and he's averaging 27 this year. He looks tremendous. But he had a moment, again, with his painted hair in the game last night against the Washington Wizards. We, of course, saw earlier this year against OG Anunoby, where his painted hair rubbed off on OG Anunoby's jersey. Jaylen Brown then went on Twitch and shaved his head. But last night, against Keyshawn George, his hair rubbed off on him again. Despite cutting his hair, despite proclaiming that he was going to get rid of the painted hair. Tom, I got to ask, you are a beautiful, bald person yourself. What's your take on Jaylen Brown just going full paint? What are your recommendations for him? Should he just shave it all off entirely and go with the beard? What do you think Jaylen Brown should do?
I'm gonna steal a line from my friend Bomani Jones here and just say, come on home. It's time to come on home. You can't keep up the lie anymore. At some point, it comes for all of us. Come on home and shave the head and put away the ink, put away the marker, and just come on home. It happened to Bomani. It happened to me a few years ago, and you just got to let it happen. Give in, okay? I know Turkey or whoever you can fly across the world in order to get this treatment. Just come on home. You know, it happened to Michael Jordan, and he still was the GOAT. You know, Ray Allen. It happened to him. Still one of the greatest, if not the greatest shooter not named Stephen Curry of all time. So come on home, Jaylen Brown. I know it's hard. I think I only committed to shaving and doing the Bic when I was like 35. This is tough for a guy who's, how old is Jaylen Brown now? 26, 27?
27, 28, something along those lines. 29 years old. 29. Just turned 29. Oh, no. Yeah.
So this is, it's going to happen. And the sooner that you do this, the better. I just, at this point, I wonder if there's like an advertising campaign that's about to happen where he's like going to endorse this company or endorse a cleaning product. Wouldn't that be great if there was like a Tide partnership that's going to happen where it's like, get your stains out of your shirts. Hi, I'm Jaylen Brown. Has this happened to you before? Well, here's how you do it.
It's
with
an opportunity for it. It's really an opportunity. Just like the Stephen A. Solitaire thing. And now everybody at ESPN is posting Solitaire ads on X. I mean,
look,
there is a chance Tide here for some brand.
We got to get Tide on line one. You know, we got to figure out a way or what would be another company that we could come in here? Mr. Clean. Hey, you get Clean. Mr. Clean. Hit two birds with one stone. You get the beautiful bald guy and you get to get that money. So, hey, Jaylen Brown, come on home. We're here. We're waiting for you. We're a very, very welcoming group. It's time to come on home.
Replace Jaylen Brown could be the new Mr. Clean. How about that?
I love it. I didn't know that he did it again last. Thank you so much for bringing this to my attention. Yep. It's got to be a bit at this point, right? Like he can't keep doing this, right?
I know. It's got to stop. Just stop with the painted hair. The full Carlos Boozer thing, you know, that look. Don't go that extreme. That's a bit much. And
So Derek White, you think Derek White sits down and just like, look, man, I had to come on home too. Like at a certain point, the giant like diaper on the top of your head that he had for so long when his hair was receding, his hairline was receding. Derek's got to sit him down, man. And just say, hey, I became basically an all-star, a champion when I did this. You too can do this and shave your head.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Jaylen's got a nice beard. He should just go with the beard. That's just my take. Go with the beard, Jaylen. If I ever went bald, I've had some receding. I think it's just a hairline that my grandpa had that'll stay this way. But if I continue receding, I'll happily go bald or fly to Turkey. One of the two. We'll see. We'll be right back. Walker Kessler, we found out he is undergoing season-ending shoulder surgery, which sucks for him. He's going to be a restricted free agent next summer, and this was a big year for him. And it also kind of sucks for the Jazz, not really, because they'd probably like to lose and have a lottery pick, but NBA University over on X posted a graphic that showed the best five-man lineups minimum 100 possessions so far this season. And number one, Utah Jazz with Walker Kessler out there so far this year had a plus 34.7 net rating, and small, tiny samples, of course, but they were good with Walker Kessler
against the Blazers too. That rating is a lot of it was against the Blazers. And I remember watching this and being like, they're not just big, they play big. And Walker Kessler, Larry Markkanen, and Filipowski, I have my issues with Filipowski dating back to the Wake Forest days when he claimed that he had this horrible knee injury after the Wake Forest stormed the court against Duke. But when you got those 3 7-footers out there, they offensive rebound, they shoot. Walker Kessler was shooting. Markkanen was a superstar. And Keontae George has looked great this year. And so in a way, I think this was a validating start for the blueprint for the Jazz, is that this three big lineup with Keontae George, they showed us something this season. And it's really tough with the economics of the league and restricted free agency really pinching a lot of these guys, especially coming off of this injury. It's going to be really tough for Walker Kessler to get full value on that contract it's really tough physically, obviously, with the shoulder surgery and the torn labrum. But I kind of feel like the Utah Jazz are going to do right by him. I mean, famous last words here, and business is business. But I feel like Walker Kessler has shown enough that he deserves a big payday at the end of this this season in restricted free agency. But this is just a huge bummer for a team that I didn't expect to be as good as they were in the early going because of that huge lineup.
Yeah, I did not expect it either. And ultimately, like, for Walker Kessler, it's only 5 games. But in those 5 games, he did look like a more developed version of himself. He hit 6 of his 8 three-point attempts, 14 of his 20 free throw attempts. So, like, a guy that ever since high school has fancied himself as one of those 7-footers that can shoot threes, never was able to do it in college, never was able to do it successfully in the NBA. Prior to the season, he was well below 25% from three-point range, below 60% from the free throw line in his career, below 55% for that matter. He didn't get an opportunity to show that the improvements were for real. And I think that's one of the separating skills that would have made him go from a 20-ish million-dollar big man who's an elite shot blocker, an elite finisher and screener, to big payday if he were it did successfully shoot over the course of the season. So disappointing for him on a personal level, obviously. For the Utah Jazz, as you said, Tom, I'd expect somebody, whether it's them or somebody else, will reward him still with a good contract because he's a damn good player. Let's move on to the Detroit Pistons. They're one of the teams we've talked about almost every team ever since the season started on my podcast so far. The Pistons are one team that we haven't brought up yet. I wanted to talk about the Pistons with you, Tom, and they are now 6-2 on the year. We saw another amazing Cade Cunningham performance on Wednesday night. He's averaging, so in the last 4 games, 28.8 points, 11.5 assists, 5 boards per game. He had 22 turnovers in his first 4 games of the season. He only has 7 in his last 4. But what I'm most interested in, what I'm most noticing with the Pistons so far this year, is the 2 big lineups. Last yes. season, in 3,961 total minutes, the Pistons had 2 bigs on the floor for only 18 minutes. This season, 80 minutes of their 384 total minutes have had 2 bigs on the floor. So 21% of the time this year, they've had 2 bigs, up from 0.5% last year, and they have a plus 19.7 net rating in those minutes, 119.7 offensive rating, 100 defensive rating. And it looks great, Tom. It looks sensational with Jalen Duren out there and Isaiah Stewart, Beef Stew, hitting threes, Jalen Duren rebounding, ripping down everything at the basket, grabbing boards. Together, their offense is scoring. Cade is still operating very well despite, in theory, a lack of space because 2 bigs and sometimes Ausar Thompson. But more than anything else, their defense is just shutting down the paint with Stewart and Duren out there together. When Duren is playing at the level that he is, a nightly double-double, blocking everything around the basket, Stewart bringing energy in on the boards, getting weak side blocks. This team is not only hard to stop when they're on offense with Cade as the engine, but their defense looks like it's taking a leap. And this 2 big thing happening around the NBA, Detroit was a team you didn't expect it to happen. 0.5% of their minutes last year, up to 20%. That's unbelievable.
It's a huge stat. I remember Monty Williams, one of the biggest gripes I had was that he was trying to make this work as Beef Stew and Jalen Duren playing at the same time, and it was a disaster. And so last year, when they started doing this with Tobias Harris at the 4 and spacing with Malik Beasley, and like, oh, wow, Cade Cunningham with shooters around him. Wow, what a brilliant idea. And then what if Beef Stew is actually a good stretch 5, and Jalen Duren, dude, I love Jalen Duren. Like, coming out of the draft, I was really upset to see that the Charlotte Hornets traded that pick away and did not bring Jalen Duren to Charlotte, where I could see him down the street on a regular basis, because I thought that dude at his age and his size, it's hard to find those kind of dudes. And right now, he's still 21 years old, fourth year in the league, 21 years old. And he looks like one of the best under 25 guys in the league. I mean, he's so big. It looks like he's got like cinder blocks for feet. He's huge. huge out there, and he's starting to play both ends of the floor at an elite level. And I love the lob threats, the rebounding, the defense. Beef Stew and Jalen Duren, the bad boy Pistons, like this identity is really interesting. It didn't work a couple years ago when these guys were, you know, 19 years old, but now as they've developed, it's been a real asset for them.
Big time, big time. They currently are 6-2. They are second in the Eastern Conference behind the 6-1 Bulls. And, you know, for Detroit, they're winning the games that they should win. They have 4 wins in a row against Orlando, Dallas, Memphis, Utah. They have Brooklyn on Friday, Philadelphia on Sunday, Washington on Monday, then Chicago again next Wednesday. So there's some tougher tests coming up for them, but everything they're doing, Cade, it was a really weird start of the year for him with all the turnovers, but I think that's just a blip. And the Cade we've seen the last 4 games is the Cade will in all likelihood see the remainder of the season. He's been this past week or so absolutely sensational. And we've seen a lot of great performances in addition to Cade over the last few days. Josh Giddey against the Sixers had 29, 15, and 12. And the game-winning assist to Vooch in the corner. Donovan Mitchell last night had 46 against the Sixers. And he said after the game he was playing, 2K. He was challenged by somebody online saying, "I ain't seen a highlight from you in a long time." And he's like, "I'll show you." And then he drops 46. And Russell Westbrook has 23, 16, and 10 against the depleted Warriors. He had 26 and 12 and 6 against the Nuggets. Russ putting up numbers for the Sacramento Kings. And then Derek Queen, he had a coming out party against the Hornets earlier in the week with 12, 8, 7, and 4 back-to-back wins for the Pelicans. And Derek Queen, Tom, here he is. He's looking good. Just going to give him an opportunity. All the Pelicans needed was for Zion to go away, apparently, to start winning games.
Yeah, and then against Dallas, he was going down the stretch and making some big plays down the stretch too. So, like, Derek Queen, I hope he's this good, man, because that trade to move up to go get this guy was one of the craziest front office moves I have ever seen covering this league. And so I hope for Joe Dumars' sake and that Pelicans franchise and the fan base in New Orleans that Derek Queen turns out to be the next Boogie Cousins, the next star, the next guy, and that the whole team can wrap their arms around. Because, man, that Indiana Pacers pick, it's I hope Derek Queen shows out. Man, I hope that it does work out for them.
I know. I really hope so for Derek Queen. I'm rooting for that kid. And I mean, ultimately, a lot of high score performances this year. If you're playing high score in fantasy, I hope you're having fun. I'm enjoying it. I like it more than standard fantasy basketball. And unfortunately, I don't have any of those guys on my teams, but I wish I did. Speaking about high scores so far this week, Tom, on Wednesday night we saw 2 MVP candidates dominate. Once again, Jokic against the Miami Heat had a massive performance with 33 points, 16 assists, 15 rebounds against Miami. Luka with the night capper against the San Antonio Spurs dropped 35, 13 assists, and 9 rebounds, which leads me to my way too early MVP rankings. At this point, we're just a handful of weeks into the season so far. I'd currently have Luka first on my MVP rankings right now. And then Jokic, SGA, Giannis, all kind of in a same similar clump, like 2A, 2B, 2C. I'd put Wemby fifth for now because of the defense, but he's had some stinkers offensively. But ultimately, Luka's averaging 40, 11, and 9.2 so far this year. Jokic, that scoring number will probably continue to rise, I would expect. But these guys, some of these numbers, like I have Giannis fourth right now. Maybe earlier in the week before some of these losses for the Bucks, I would have had Giannis first. Just to be clear to the Bucks fans, don't get too mad at me. They've dropped some games, but Giannis is having an unbelievable individual season. It's just kind of nuts, Tom, what some of these guys are doing right now in the NBA. I mean, Luka, he might actually average 40 or close to it this year with the way in which that he's performing right now. He really might.
I mean, the numbers are MVP worthy. I would probably put him like 2 or 3 on my fake way too early ballot just because he's only played 5 of the 9 games. And so are going to look at your performances, I look at Giannis and I look at Wemby and I look at Jokic. Shea coming off the second night of a back-to-back, getting in at 3 a.m. and still balling out against the Blazers. I just feel like I might put them, give them a little bit more of an edge because of that they've been there every night. But Luka, what's Dallas doing right now? I kind of feel like if you traded Luka last year, I kind of feel like you must have gotten a huge package and Dallas is doing really well to trade that guy who's number one on your MVP ballot, right? Things are going well in Dallas?
Pretty tough. I mean, it's just kind of, it's pretty tough for them.
And, oh, really?
I mean, ultimately, yeah, it's pretty tough losing to the Pelicans. But ultimately with these MVPs, I think with Luka specifically, yeah, you're right about the games played. And, you know, hopefully he stays healthy the remainder of the year. But the fact the Lakers are 7-2 with him missing that time, Austin Reeves, of course, had his big mega performances. The fact LeBron hasn't played a game yet for the Lakers, and the Lakers are 7-2 so far in the year. They look good, and I thought in that game against the Spurs last night, DeAndre Ayton, man, ever since his pretty poor opening night performance, he's been awesome. Ayton, 22 points, 10 rebounds last night, playing pretty well on defense, putting in great effort. I'll tell you what, Tom, like Ayton looks like one of those guys where when he cares, when things are good around him, he puts in great effort and he looks like a very good player. When things are off, when the team's not winning, he's not going to put up big numbers as we saw last year with the Blazers and really put in any level of consistent effort. But the difference between the Ayton you saw last year covering the Blazers and the Ayton we're seeing right now with the Lakers is just night and day. I mean, like, this is going to be a shock to your system seeing this transition for DeAndre Ayton.
He showed out against the Blazers, you know, coming back to Portland and doing what he did, showed out big time. Just every time down the stretch, the Lakers got him the ball and he's not going to get to the free throw line. He's not going to go through you, but that jump hook and that mid-range jumper was as money as it's ever been. And so when you're able to get those open looks in the paint like that, DA is going to convert. And when he's setting hard screens, when he's rebounding, when he's got a chip on his shoulder, he's good. And I got to say, he outplayed Wemby, Kev. He outplayed Wemby on Wednesday night. And I certainly, after the way that Wemby started this season, would never have seen that coming based on the way that both of those guys came out of the gate this season. Never in my wildest dreams would I be able to think I could be able to say DA outplayed Victor Wembanyama in the year 2025. Just didn't think it was possible. And sure enough, he did, like, straight up. And I didn't see that coming. I thought Wemby, the way that he started the season, the first opening four games, that he realized, I'm going to be physical. I'm going to play through you. I'm 7'7" now, or whatever we're going to call him. And I just thought, against a guy like DeAndre Ayton, who does not like that kind of physicality as much as some other guys, that Wemby would just eat him for lunch. And that did not happen. The opposite, quite honestly, Wemby did not have a strong game. The second kind of dud that he's had this week, I thought DA was excellent. And I do think that, you know, we'll see after 82 games and come playoff time how this looks. But the guy did play in the NBA Finals with the Phoenix Suns. So it's not out of the question that he can't put it all together for a full 100 games. Lakers have to be happy with the effort they've seen.
Speaking about Wemby, you wrote a great article over at Yahoo Sports about his usage on national TV this year. Entering the year, he had 22 games on national TV. They flexed out and flexed in a Spurs game later this month where there'll be 23 national TV games. Can you kind of detail what you wrote about and why you think the Spurs need to be on national TV a lot more?
I just think we're going to come to a point in the NBA landscape where there's no KD, there's no Steph, there's no LeBron, and I think the NBA should invest more in Wemby. He is Shohei Ohtani, he is Caitlin Clark, where you have to watch what this guy does on a nightly basis because he's going to do something new you've never seen before. The highlights, the sheer, like, I can pull out my cousin who's never watched a game of basketball and have her look at the screen. And she'll be like, who's that guy? You need that kind of guy on your TV as much as possible if you're the NBA. And they've done a good job of marketing him globally. He's number one in social media views, not just in America, but also in Europe and in Asia. Wemby's the number one guy. But when it comes to national TV appearances, which is the biggest moneymaker for the leagues and the NBA domestically, the way that they market their players is getting them on NBC, getting them on network television and ESPN. And the weird thing is, despite all of that social media buzz and the physical appearance and the fact that he's, you know, 7 foot seven, the NBA selected just 22 national TV games for him outside the top 10. A Kyrie Irving-less Dallas Mavericks team had more. The Boston Celtics without Jason Tatum and Kristaps Porzingis and Drew Holiday, clearly downshifting this season. The NBA decided to put them on more than Wemby. And I just feel like we need to have this guy on at the max number of times. And I didn't know this before I was reporting this story, but there is a cap that broadcasters can put each team on their air. So the ESPN ABC networks, they can only put on a certain team 13 times, max 13 times. And with NBC, NBA and NBC and Peacock, it's 11 times. And with Amazon Prime, it's 10 times. So the max that you're going to get for a Wemby or a LeBron or Steph is 34 games on national TV. Wemby, he's got to be at 34, Kev. I just think for the future of the sport and to grow this tent of NBA fans, I feel like Wemby singularly is such a charismatic and interesting figure, and he's so good at basketball. We need to invest in this dude now, not in 3 years when those guys are not playing anymore. Like now.
It is shocking that it wasn't more than the 22 it was entering the season. You know what I mean? Like, it's just really weird. Like, you would think for a player, the NBA, they themselves talk about how he leads and, you know, numbers on social media, how he's breaking records and all that. Like you know how it is on our end of things too. Like, Wemby does well. Like, people love to talk about and listen to and think about Victor Wembanyama. And so for the NBA to put the Spurs on only 22 times, then have to flex them in, I felt like it was almost them thinking, we're not sure this team is going to be good. Kind of like the Zion thing a few years ago when they put Zion on a bunch that ended up being a mistake, and they paid for it. But the fact you could always flex them out. I'd rather have a high amount at first and then flex out if he's missing time or the Spurs aren't any good. I think it should be much higher.
It might be nitpicking for me because I think NBA on NBC and Amazon Prime have done a superb job coming in and marketing and programming the NBA. They've done an amazing job. If I'm going to nitpick, we cannot have Wemby making his debut on NBA on NBC December 29th. That was the plan, was to wait 2 months into the season before we put this dude on NBA on NBC until December 29th after Christmas. Now, they have since fixed that, and by flexing in the Memphis game in November, they're going to get Wemby on NBC earlier. But I thought from the get-go, knowing that he was cleared physically back in July, we were going to have Wemby as part of this NBA on NBC opening package. And it seemed like it just didn't work out. It was very confusing to me why 17 NBA teams would get on NBC's air before Wemby. And now they're trying to fix that. And I'm glad they're doing it because I think he is the real deal. And I think that with KD, Steph, and LeBron aging out, we do need that guy. And Wemby, by all accounts, is that dude.
And we'll be right back after this break. Well, Tom, the other takeaway from that Wednesday night performance, and really everything that's happened all season, is the fact that Luka continues to dominate while the Dallas Mavericks absolutely stink. So we have a special guest barging in here, slightly biased. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm just doing fantastic.
I can tell. I saw you on playback on Wednesday night reacting to the Mavericks losing to the Pelicans, and boy, oh boy, a very organic moment reacting to the state of the Dallas Mavericks. I'm sorry. This freaking sucks, man. It does.
Yeah, I mean, it sucks because it's the worst start I can imagine to the season. 2-6, AD's missed half the games. Derek Lively's missed half the games. You're so injured. And now You can't even enjoy the process of having an 18-year-old number one overall pick because you were promised that this was a team that was going to win. Like I was saying, last night's game against the Pelicans, probably Flagg's best game from beginning to end, had a chance to tie it at the end. It was a good shot. He just missed it. And I was after the game, I was like, man, that's a loss that if he's on the Wizards or something, those fans are like, that was cool. Like, that's fine. We're tanking, whatever. It doesn't matter. Like, Cooper looked great for the Mavs. This team traded their franchise megastar, 25-year-old franchise megastar 10 months ago, and can't beat the Zion-less Pelicans at home. The Pelicans on the second night of a back-to-back. It's just a catastrophe.
Terrible time. Hey,
Kev, can I just jump in here and say, yes, I'm sorry, man. I am so sorry. Like, watching them has been abomination when it comes to how they've the Cooper Flagg experiment at point guard. Their offensive rating is dead last in the NBA. And if you look at the NBA average in offensive rating is 115 points, okay? The Mavericks are at 103 as a team. And when they have Cooper Flagg, Anthony Davis, Klay Thompson, and PJ Washington on the floor, it goes from 103 to 86. What is that? You have your veterans, you have the vision, and they're on the floor, and they can't score. They can't score. So, like, I know the whole defense wins championships. We make fun of that from Nico Harrison. But I also know that being last in offense also does not win championships. It can't be this bad, can it?
Yeah, it can be, I think. All offseason, I said they have to be a top three defense because I didn't think their offense was going to be good enough. So they had to be an elite-level defense. Their defense has been good, but their offense has just been so dreadful. Last night, they finally started D'Angelo Russell, which was something anyone who was watching Mavs games was clamoring for. Why not just start a point guard? I get they're doing trial by fire with Coop at the one, but he wasn't a point guard. Like, you're drafting him as a Swiss Army knife forward who could be a point forward down the line. And I was okay with them having possession or having, you know, stretches over the course of a game where maybe they have a point guard Coop lineup over the course of a game, not starting the season. I went over this a couple of days ago on a show I was on. They, there's a couple other tweets I fired out too last night. If you want to pull those ones out,
it's a family program.
Yeah.
But, you look at Coop's played, he's been guarded by Stephon Castle. He's been guarded by Lou Dort. He's been guarded by Amen Thompson. He's been guarded by Asar Thompson. It's just, you're not doing this kid any favors at all. And their offense has just been so bad. It's crazy that D'Lo has one of the craziest on-off swings of the entire NBA so far this season. D'Angelo Russell has been one of the most valuable players in the league this year by on-off metrics because of how much better this offense looks with a guard. So we'll see if last night is a sign of things to come. But even then, they were terrible last night. So I don't know.
It's honestly just so depressing. I mean, like, Luka's averaging 40 this year, and he's looks fitter than he ever has. I think he's, you know, only 5 of 9 games, but for pure production, number one in MVP rankings right now. So far, the Lakers look great. And then for Dallas, you get this guy, Nico Harrison, who makes this selfish trade, stupid trade. And then he has he says fortune favors the bold. Defense wins championships. He trades Luka, this 25-year-old megastar, for a guy who misses more games than any other top 10, 15 player in the whole NBA who's on the wrong side of 30. And as you said earlier, simply, this is a worst-case scenario right now where he is missing half the games. All these guys are out, and you can't even enjoy the number one pick you lucked into in Cooper Flagg. I said last season the Mavericks need to fire Nico Harrison, clean their hands of this, feel like they have a clean slate. What are we waiting for at this point? If you're Mavericks ownership, what is the wait? What are they waiting for here, simply? I don't get it.
I think that my personal opinion is I don't think the Dumonts and Adelsons care much at all about basketball. That's just the vibe I've been giving off. You know, there was that infamous interview that Patrick Dumont was on where he listed off all of the hardest workers in NBA history and mentioned Shaquille O'Neal's name and didn't mention Dirk's name. So was that
him doing that as like some shot at them slightly, you think? Is that what that was? Is that petty?
Don't ask him to explain Patrick Dumont's ways. No one can get inside that man's head.
Look, I would otherwise kind of just explain away him calling the conference finals the championship games or the NBA finals the championship games. It's just like a misspeak in the moment of an interview. But I don't know. I thought the moment they bought the team, it felt like a business move. They want a casino resort in Dallas, Texas. That's what they want to build ultimately. Whether or not the Mavs were going to be a part of that in some way. The new stadium, their lease is up in 2030, I think. So the new stadium would be a part of this luxury casino resort once gambling gets legalized. It's been a whole thing here in Texas, so it's been slow for them. So I don't think they really care about basketball. I mean, that's my personal belief. So they gave the full reins to Nico. And I do think they're using this. I think they have it in their back pocket, though, because they've had PR people come in. They brought in Rick Welts. Like, they know, okay, things are bad here. Our fans are very upset. But we do have this get-out-of-jail-free card almost. The moment we fire Nico Harrison, our approval rating is going to shoot up. Even if ultimately we're the ones that allowed this to happen, because a big trade like this, the owners could always step in and say, you're not doing something like this on my watch. But I just don't think they care. I don't think they know much about it personally. And I just think Nico was just like, hey, this is the right move. And they're like, okay, cool. And now they've got to ride it out.
Tom, do you think the Mavericks are in a position right now that they should just blow it up? They have the fourth best lottery odds at this point. Is this a window here? Just pivot away from trying to win and just trade everybody besides Cooper?
Yeah, build around Cooper. Build around Cooper. They should have done this when they got the number one pick and just said, look, Kyrie's out. AD is unreliable. Go find another contender that you can build around, you know, an AD and try to win a championship. We're not on that timeline right now. This is all about Cooper Flagg. And my question is, what if they didn't get Cooper Flagg? What if they didn't luck out and get the number one overall pick? Is it almost worse, or is it somehow better that they would be able to, like, all right, we're just going to have to restart and figure things out. The Luka trade was bad, but you know what? We're just going to sit in this whole AD and Kyrie situation. But I almost feel like getting Cooper Flagg almost exposes the lack of vision and the sheer dysfunction in this organization, that it almost pains me even more to watch Cooper Flagg be utilized in this way. 18-year-old big playing point guard. It's sad. Kev, you said it was sad. I think it's very clear they need to build around Cooper and do what's best for him long term, because this AD, Klay Thompson, Kyrie hasn't played and it's going to be a while. I don't see how this works.
Slightly. You agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, my thought was, well, you did the part of the rebuild that so many other rebuilding teams are desperate for. You got your number one overall pick. You got the franchise guy in Cooper Flagg. I thought, you know, having AD, having Kyrie, trying to be competitive, that could be good for his development long term. Like, I get the idea of wanting to rebuild and shut it down, but let's see what we've got first. And at the deadline, if you want to make that decision, that's fine. I didn't expect it to be this bad right out the gates. I didn't expect AD to be injured already right out the gates. So, yeah, I mean, they do have an important decision to make, because this is the last season they have full control of their pick until 2031. So they do have to decide fairly quickly, is this something we want to do? We want to go after one of these top-end lottery guys in this loaded draft coming up, pair him with Coop, we'll rebuild, we'll reset, we'll fire Nico, we'll do all of these things, and Cooper and whoever, you know, AJ DeBanza, let's go. Let's go all in for him. I don't know. I don't think they're not going to do it with Nico Harrison in charge. I promise you that. He has to get fired first.
Slightly. I mean, yeah, he definitely has to get fired first. I'm curious. Like, we've seen some Mavs fans kind of stray away from the team. Jason Gallagher over at Old Man in the Three has kind of taken on the Thunder. And, you know, they have some Mavs fans who have sort of become just Luka fans, sort of like there's LeBron fans. There were fans of the Cavs and then fans of the Heat and fans of the Lakers and all that. Like, they just follow LeBron. And now they're just Luka fans. For you, has your Mavericks fandom, like, kind of declined at all, or are you still, because I sense still a lot of Mavericks fan passion from you at this point still, but has it wavered?
It's more just very frustrating to watch the games than anything else. I'll be honest. You know, I do Locked On Mavs after every game with Nick Engstat. If it weren't for that, yeah, for sure there are games I wouldn't watch. Or there are times where I would be like, okay, the Spurs-Lakers are on. Like, I'll catch the flag minutes and that'll be that. But since I'm on the postgame shows, you know, I need to make sure I know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. We'll see if by February, I might be going on in February shows not watching a single second of the game. He's like, yeah, that was a nice play by Brandon Williams there in the third quarter. But no, I mean, I don't blame any fan. I've watched every Spurs game this season. I've watched every Thunder game this season. I have not watched every Mavericks game. Because I was at a friend's thing for their loss against the Pistons. I was like, I'm not going back rewatching that trash. So,
what's it like watching Luka right now?
So, no offense to you or the Lakers, but it's difficult. It is for me. I love Luka. Like, I really do. It's just, it bugs me that it's the Lakers, which is weird because I liked the Lakers before. I love LeBron. It's just the fact the trade was what it was, I think, is what is so angry, makes me so angry. It's nothing like Luka. I'm happy he's doing good, but it's like, I can't believe that franchise got Luka for nothing. But I feel like I would have felt that if it was like the Spurs or, you know, anyone.
It's just heartbreaking. I just feel for, because the Matt, like, I've growing up in Boston, like, you know this, Tom. You're a Red Sox fan. Like, you like some Boston sports teams, even though you cover the Blazers now. Boston sports fans are amazing. The passion, the intensity, the love is so real. And when I visited Dallas for the first time, that's one of the best home crowds in the whole NBA. Like, you can feel it when you walk through the concourse. You can feel it in the arena. You can feel it outside of the arena. Mavericks fans are so hardcore. And like, it reminds me of the passion that I grew up with covering watching the Celtics, being a fan of the Patriots and Red Sox and Bruins. It's like that in Dallas with the Mavericks. And the fact that it happened to those fans, to you slightly, that's the part that I feel like I can relate to, because it's just like, really, they have to go through this of all fan bases? It just sucks, man. It just blows. And I just hope there's like a light at the end of the tunnel for the Mavericks. I can't see it at the moment. I don't think I'll be able to see it until Nico Harrison is gone. And there's clearly a right vision for this franchise. But right now, as you said, Tom, they should have blown it up when they got the number one pick. They didn't. At this point, they're 2-6. They stink. You can't even enjoy Cooper Flagg. They need a clean slate. That's all it is, slightly. They need a clean slate. And that includes getting rid of Nico. That includes trading these older veterans for a great return. That includes having hope on in May again for another top pick and moving forward with the franchise. I think that's the only way. It's the only way to move past it, is a clean slate. And until that happens, it's just impossible.
So I do feel a little bad, because I agree with you, where it's just like, this, things are so bleak. And then I'll have a Jazz fan or a Wizards fan who's like, man, we've been waiting for 30 years for a Cooper Flagg, for a Luka Doncic. You guys have had all of this. I don't feel bad for you. I get all that. That's totally fair. But, you know, we were right there. We were in the finals. This was a young team, too. That's what was kind of exciting, is, yeah, Kyrie's over 30, but Luka, PJ Washington, Gafford, Lively, all these guys are in their young to mid-20s, and then that gets completely and totally thrown away. I mean, I'm a little bit more pessimistic for the long term, because I'm worried about this ownership group significantly. So yep. My big hope is that maybe if they do fire Nico, maybe they realize, okay, we might be a little in over our heads in terms of the basketball stuff. Our PR is so bad. We need to just make sure whoever we hire with the help of somebody who knows what they're doing basketball-wise, right? And it's not just us going out there and doing it. That's what I'm concerned about. I remember when, you know, Cuban was kind of a polarizing figure in Dallas, as hard as that might be to believe. And I think a lot of that's because he was the face of the franchise in a lot of ways before, in that little like Dirk twilight of his career before Luka. It was Cuban and trying to make all these moves and stuff. I remember when people were wanting him to sell a team, the one thing I always said was, I would be careful. It is very easy to have a bad owner in sports, and you could do way worse than Mark Cuban. And that's my big concern right now. Like, Nico Harrison will get fired. If this season goes this way, he will be fired, and that will be the end of that. I'm just worried what comes next. and long term over the next 10, 20, 30 years, what does this look like with this ownership group? That's my big concern, honestly.
I think that's spot on slightly. Thank you so much for joining me on Short Notice. We got to do a full pod at some point in the weeks ahead, man. But yes, appreciate you joining, man. You're free to go. Thank you for coming on.
Thank free you slightly.
Yes, it's great to see you slightly. Tom, that was fun. Thank you as well for coming on today, Tom. There's a lot of topics. We hit a ton of teams here, man. This was fun, man. We got a big week ahead of you. And you got any more Blazers games coming rest of this week, Tom?
Oh, yeah. We got Wednesday was OKC, and then Saturday we got the Miami Heat. And just want to give a quick shout out. Prayers up for Eric Spoelstra. We learned overnight that his house was engulfed in flames, and fortunately, no one was hurt by that. But just want to give thoughts and prayers over to Eric Spoelstra and his family going through. I mean, just nothing that anyone wants to go through right now. And I'm glad that everyone is safe. Bam Adebayo is dealing with that foot injury. And so we'll see, you know, the Blazers on Saturday night in Miami, what kind of team that the Heat are going to have on that game. But I will say, I'm excited to see this up-tempo Miami Heat team that Noah LaRoche and the way that Spo has these guys playing. I'm looking forward to seeing these two very up-tempo teams, the two fastest teams in pace in the NBA on Saturday night. It's going to be really fun to watch. And I hope Bam Adebayo plays because he's been balling out this year, and especially with that three-point shot.
I know. It's very, very cool to see Bam. And as you said, the scenes from Spo's home were just horrifying. You know, hopefully I'm very, very glad that people are safe. It's unfortunate. I'm sure, you know, lost probably some very personal things in anybody's home. Anytime a house burns down, and hopefully, some things were at least, you know, taken out involving family and whatnot. If I don't know any details about it, I just saw the video, and it's just horrifying to imagine that happening. Tom, thank you so much for joining me today, man. I look forward to, you'll be back again every Thursday remainder of this season, man. It'll be fun.
Yeah. Hopefully my beard won't be out to here the next time I come on. You know, I grew a beard in between appearances.
Tom, I mean, look, your beard has looked sensational. You're a bit more well-kept than I am. I'm due for a good trim. I've done a little bit of upkeep, but I got to do a nice cleanup of my beard. I'm getting a little too scruffy at this point. Getting look like I belong in the streets. I got this HD camera. I got to look sharp for for the podcast on here.
Just don't go see Jaylen Brown's barber, okay? Just no, don't.
Never. The Carlos Boozer thing is a big turnoff, you know? Like, ever since I saw him with his painted hair 12, 15 years ago, however long it was, I'm like, I would never do such a thing. And Jaylen Brown, he clearly felt, I would love to do this someday if it ever happens to me. I'm glad, Tom, that you shaved your head. Bald and beautiful. There's nothing wrong with being bald. If you were one of my bald listeners, please comment and give us your thoughts on what Jaylen Brown should do. Tom, Mr. Talk to you next Thursday, man.
Thank you, man. Always good to be on. Appreciate you. Glad to be back.
Thank you, Tom. Big thank you to Tom Haverstraw and Slightly Biased for joining me. We have a special guest, Donovan Mitchell from the Cleveland Cavaliers, joined to talk about some trends around the NBA. So let's get to that right now. All right, joining me now is guard for the Cleveland Cavaliers, Donovan Mitchell. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Kev. How are you doing?
I want to talk about overall NBA trends, because Cleveland Cavaliers, one of the trends I'm noticing with you guys this year, last year you pressed 2.2 times per game. This year you're up to 4.9 times per game. That's a fraction of what we're seeing teams like the Blazers and the Raptors do this season, but it's becoming a league-wide thing with more pressure. And Cleveland has also had a higher pickup point as well this year. What's behind this? Why do you see teams doing this more often across the league?
Yeah, so I feel like it's at that point. I'm at that point where it's like weird for me to say that, like, I'm starting to find the league is shifting, right? Like, I'm 9 years in and you're starting to see that. And I think it's kind of like one of those things where you see teams have success with it, the Pacers, the Thunder, and they were in the finals. So I think you're starting to see teams start to gravitate towards that, playing at a faster pace, trying to create turnovers, more possessions. And that's what you're really, I think, you're starting to get to.
Now, you've seen teams do this against you so far this season as well. The Raptors and Celtics did that, I think, more than anybody. And I'm curious, from your perspective as a guy who brings up the ball a lot, what are the challenges in dealing with it? What are some of the counters that you guys use to, when you do see press or at least a higher pickup point?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is alleviating pressure. So it's necessarily having, you know, we call it an X screen, you know, where the big just comes up and sets it higher. So it makes it gets the defender off you. If he decides to chase you over, now full speed downhill at the big. Typically, somebody helps. You can kick out some sprays. That's kind of another thing. Or sometimes grateful to have Evan Mobley. Just give it to him and let him run a zoom action and pick where he wants to go each side. So just a few things that we have to alleviate that pressure.
Now, one of the things, you know, during that Cavs-Pacers series last year, Kenny Atkinson used the word force a lot. And he talked about like maintaining intensity from start to finish of games and like how impressive it was. Indiana was able to do that in the way they did and all the way until game seven. With you guys, like, it feels like adding a guy like Lonzo Ball adds a bit of that pace and all that that he kind of is hitting on. Do you feel kind of the personality of the team has shifted a bit this year so far? I know it's early.
1,000%, but I felt this during OTAs. You know what I mean? We were trying to get the ball across half court, past half court in 3 seconds. And then when you got a guy like Lonzo who does that instinctively himself, right? Like, I think that's something that you could just see where we're trying to do this. And all about finding ways to kick ahead. So it's not just with the dribble, right? It's finding ways to get the ball ahead, drop the defense, you get the ball back, now you play pick and roll. But the addition of Lonzo, you see his speed. He just takes off as a one-man fast break, and he's always looking to find guys. But it also makes our lives a lot easier because now if you have our bigs running, like Ev or Jay, they're punishing switches. You know, if we're contesting and we're leaking out, getting down floor, just easy ways to get buckets.
Now with you, your last year in Utah, you ran 35.5 pick and rolls per game. This year, you're at 23.8, and that follows a league-wide trend. Pick and rolls are down across the board. 5 years ago, it was at 140, then fell to 137 per game, 136, 129. This year so far, it's 126 pick and rolls per game. Why do you think teams are running fewer pick and rolls per game across the board?
Well, I think it's part of the being picked up. Like, you know, if I'm getting picked up and I'm just going to go by you, if you tell somebody you have the entire court damn near to just get downhill, you're going to get downhill without even using the screen. You're not going to bring an extra guy into it. You know, sometimes you do to alleviate that pressure if it's slower, I mean, obviously. But I think if you're getting the ball out the rim and you're kicking it ahead, there's no need for a pick and roll. You're getting right to a three, and we're getting shots up so fast as a league, not just as the Cavs. I think that's kind of why things are going down.
I mean, I think I would imagine like also switching defense as well against certain opponents. Yeah. If it's just a switch, like, well, oh, okay, we're just creating another ISO or another post up. It's just a waste of time in some ways. So it is interesting, though. I mean, like last year, Memphis did their whole thing with no screens, really. This year, Miami's doing a bit of that. It's like kind of like crazy. Like looking around the NBA, all the dramatically different playing styles that you see teams using these days.
Yeah, it's interesting. And like I said, it's crazy to see how far in the span of 9 years, the league is starting to shift into that direction of more just kind of read and react, right? Concept based, not necessarily play based, which is good because it's hard to scout. Like, you know what I mean? If you don't know on a consistent basis every night, all right, they're running floppy, right? Or like they're running turn five, you know, okay, cool. Like you don't know, hey, it may be this, everybody's a threat, right? And you're seeing teams try to target depth too. Like you're not trying to have, you know, 6-7 strong. You're trying to have a long roster. So now you can kind of play at this pace, play at that speed. When guys get tired, you're able to rotate in and out. So it's interesting.
What do you think some of the next trends are in the NBA?
Honestly, I think we go faster as a league. I think there's another level to this pace. I don't know what that is, but I'm just starting to see like it's starting to be like a no conscience, just get it and throw it. Like Atlanta, they are one of the best at it. I think Boston's trying to do that with Joe and those guys. Like you get it and you're gone. Like, and I think there's like another level of that. I think you're starting to see it with Indiana, but like Indiana being the only team to have that pace in the playoffs, you're going to see 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 teams that are in the playoffs playing at that pace. I think pace and space is like the name of the game. And I think it's going to be even more so.
I mean, I think, like, you know, we're talking about like full court press requiring sometimes, you know, more effort and a deeper bench and all that, more bodies. But I think playing fast on offense, I'd imagine that can exhaust you too.
1,000%, especially if a team you're playing. Like, you look at the Indiana series, like, we weren't running fast, so to speak, but we were still running because they were picking us up full court. And then on top of that, we would score, turnover, you miss a layup, miss a shot, and here they go right back to the other end. So it's really, there's no breaks, all right? And I think that's, you got to train for that. You got to be in shape for that. You got to be mentally ready for that. So that's what you're starting to see.
Now, with you watching your game, I've always felt like you're one of the more stylish players in the game. Like, with your handle, your shiftiness, and your explosiveness, like, that combination is pretty rare. And you're already a great player. You know, 6-time All-Star at this point, 2-time All-NBA. You've had highs in the postseason, highs in the regular season. What are the things that when you assessed yourself after the playoffs ended last year, entering the summer, what were the things that you thought, okay, I need to get better at this? And what did you work on this offseason?
I mean, I talk about it every year, but like my efficiency, right? And I don't mean necessarily, oh, I got to shoot 70% from the field, 45 from three. Like, that obviously would be fantastic. But I think my biggest thing is, it's the little things. Like, this year, we talk about playing fast, but it's not always with the dribble, right? I kick ahead. You know, letting somebody create and then I benefit off of that. Or they may create and be able to go ahead and score, right? Like, being able to find ways to make the game easy. And I think last year I took a step in that direction. Every year I think I'm taking a step, right? I think last year really opened my eyes to, like, okay, there's success here. Like, okay, cool. Like, and we also have the talent to be able to do this, where it's like, I get off it to DG, he creates. Now they're helping on DG. I'm able to get a simple catch and shoot three, right? And I didn't have to do any work. Like, I didn't do anything, but also be ready when my time is called to be able to shoot off the dribble, get in the paint, create. But when I talk about efficiency, it's like efficiency with my movements. You don't always have to be head, like, down at the rim trying to jump into people, jump over. Like, being really efficient with my mid-range jump shots, picking my spots to attack, to let off the gas, and be able to allow guys to continue to elevate the way I really did last year. I'm starting to continue to build up.
I remember years ago, I think it was, might have been, you were still in Utah, I don't know, it was like 5 years ago or something like that, you and I had a conversation for an interview, and you told me about how one of the things you learned was, like, sometimes in order to maintain your energy over the season, you have to learn how to take days off.
Man.
Do you feel like at this point in your career, you've got that mastered? Like, you just know how to pace the whole year?
It's funny you say that, because I literally am having a conversation with Tyrese Proctor today in the cold tub, and he's like, man, like, I'm getting mad because the coaches are telling me to sit down. It's like, I got to keep shooting because I haven't made a shot. And it's like, it's so crazy that you bring that up, because I'm sitting here like, no, like, they're right. Like, you don't need to do anything. You got 2 days off. Like, you can go shoot tomorrow. Like, you know what I mean? But it's funny hearing him say that, because I know where that's coming from, right? Like, we spoke about it. It's like, now I'm able to be like, all right, cool. Like, maybe I'm not practicing as much, saving yourself. And also with the game being the way it is, like, you can't do both. Like, you know what I mean? It's a long season. You can't be running full 36 minutes a night, full speed, and then also come down here and practice, do the same thing. You got to pick. And also, so when you're in practice, picking your spots, still being involved, but still finding ways to sometimes just sit down and do nothing. And it's a film day, you know? So I've definitely gotten much better at that, for sure.
I mean, you're the old vet now, right?
I know. Being the fourth oldest on the team is wild, for sure.
Fourth oldest on the team.
It's wild.
It is crazy how the years go by. I was looking at your numbers before our interview today. It's like, damn, like, it's his fourth year in Cleveland already?
They tell me I played 200 games already. So it's like, it's wild how fast this goes.
It really is crazy. So, Donovan, thank you so much for joining me today, man.
Yeah, I appreciate you, Kev. Thank you.
Big thank you to Tom Haberstroh, Slightly Biased, and Donovan Mitchell for joining me on today's episode. Thank you to Emmy, Dakota, and Sarah for producing today's episode. Thank you to Father John Misty for the music, as always. And I hope you really enjoyed your time listening to this episode. We'll be back again next Monday. Lots to talk about in the NBA, college basketball world, with the first week of games over there. Can't wait to get to it. Hope you enjoy your weekend. Have a good one.